The Biden agenda, foreign and domestic. What's facing the new administration? President Biden has already reversed many of the actions taken by his predecessor, Donald Trump, from rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement to halting the Keystone XL pipeline. He has made it clear that he will take as many executive actions as possible to redirect the course of American policy and change the way the rest of the world views us. But these are tricky and complicated times, and not everything can happen with the stroke of a pen. Biden faces a divided Congress and shifting geopolitical realities, not to mention a global pandemic and economic recession. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we discuss the national and international challenges facing the Biden administration. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Former Senator and Vice President Hubert Humphrey once said, "Foreign policy is really domestic policy with its hat on." Today, we're going to discuss how domestic issues may limit the focus of the Biden administration when it comes to its international agenda. My guest, Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former State Department Middle East analyst who served as negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. He is a CNN Global Affairs analyst and the author, most recently, of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Gordon Adams was the chief national security budget official for President Bill Clinton. He is emeritus professor at American University and currently a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. He's a resident of Brunswick, Maine, and a poet. We invite your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. And Aaron David Miller, I'll start with you. We are in the middle, obviously, of a global pandemic, a global recession, a divided nation. And one could argue, I think, that this incoming administration faces the toughest situation since perhaps World War II.
I'd agree. First, let me say, Jennifer, it's an honor to be here. I love Maine and I love Maine Calling, and it's great to be here with Gordon Adams. I mean, I think your comment is apt in large part because Biden does face the greatest set of crises since any American president, with the exception of Franklin Roosevelt. If Doris Kearns Goodwin were here, she would tell you that probably that crisis, the crisis he faces, is on par with the one Lincoln faced as well. And never has the connection, frankly, between our dysfunction at home and the reputational hit that we have had taken as a response of our very poor response to COVID, class and political and racial disparities spilling out into the streets, and an economic recession that has left economists, with the recent jobs report, 49,000 new jobs created, scratching their heads, created a situation where our domestic dysfunction is on display, and it has delighted adversaries, and it has worried allies. So I think Mr. Biden wants to be a foreign policy president. He's appointed a team, we can talk a little bit about that later, that is very skilled, in whom he has great confidence. But I think governing is about choosing, and I think the Biden administration will have to pick its spots abroad extremely carefully. We cannot afford foreign policy misadventures and squandered presidential currency in pursuit of objectives we cannot achieve.
And when you talk about choosing those priorities carefully, this is something that, you know, I'm thinking back to President Obama trying to shift the focus east. Of course, reality made that not possible. What would you be advising President Biden today if you could?
I mean, I think, well, other than avoiding trillion-dollar social science experiments, which, like Iraq and Afghanistan, which is another issue he's going to have to grapple with, it's prioritizing American foreign policy so that the driving forces become American security and American prosperity. And I think that, to some degree, would make China a priority, but it would also make a priority issues that have long been ignored or subordinated to more traditional foreign policy concerns. Climate is critically important, as is the greatest threat to public health since the great influenza of 1918. Think about it. We spent billions of dollars since in the wake of 9/11 in an effort to counter what we thought was the greatest challenge to the health and well-being of the United States. And we've been relatively successful. Not a single terrorist attack orchestrated by a foreign terror organization since 9/11, perhaps with the exception of the attack in Pensacola. But when the real threat came to the Republic, it didn't come from Islamic extremists. It came from a virus, which has done the kind of damage to the United States that these terrorists would have loved to have done. And since two-thirds of the newly discovered pathogens in the world today are viruses, this is the other priority: pandemic, China, and climate.
Gordon Adams, I'm going to bring you into the conversation now. You have said you would not want the job that Joe Biden faces today. Gordon, are you there? Well, shoot, let's hope that we can get that fixed and bring Gordon Adams. Oh, go ahead. Gordon Adams, are you there?
Can you hear me now? Yep.
Yes, I can. So I just wanted to mention, I saw that you've said you wouldn't want Joe Biden's job.
There's no way I would want this job. I can't imagine a president who has more challenges facing him right now ever maybe, but certainly only Franklin Delano Roosevelt and maybe Abe Lincoln faced a more massive array of challenges, and they're all interrelated with each other. Aaron talks about COVID and China and climate, but you've got democracy and racism on top of it, and you've got a political system in Washington which is so stalled at this point and so narrow in terms of the margins he has to govern with. So the challenges are enormous. I can't imagine how he is going to have to spend his days, hands off to Kamala Harris and other folks, because it's just going to be insuperable. And it's both domestic and international. And many of them, as with COVID, for example, are inseparable.
Gordon Adams, Joe Biden has said he wants a return to American leadership, America at the head of the table. Is that possible?
No, I don't think it's possible. And there, I think some adjustments are going to have to be made. A lot of people look at this as a restoration, a return to American leadership. As you say, he's called it being back at the head of the table. The table has changed. Power has redistributed around the world, not just because of what Donald Trump has done, but because of the shifts that have gone on for 20 or 30 years now. China is one of them. A playful Russia is another one of them. But even beyond that, you've got Iran able to work at will in its own region, Saudi Arabia taking its own path. You've got the European Union signing a trade agreement with the Chinese and kind of thumbing their nose at the United States, saying they don't really want to be in a coalition against China. They want to play kind of on their own sandbox. So we have a real shift in power and a growth in the autonomy of various nations regionally and internationally. And we're going to have to play a different game. It's not going to be the indispensable nation, the natural leader. We're going to have to play multilaterally. We're going to have to learn how to use our diplomatic capabilities to work in very subtle ways and supple ways, sharing power with other states, not intervening in every situation in the world, and not assuming that anybody else is demanding that we do it. So it's a different kind of game. It's a balance of power world with a lot of regional changes. And I think right now it's not yet clear how the Biden administration is going to cope with that reality.
Aaron David Miller, what do you think of that, the notion that America is no longer at the head of the table?
Wise words from Gordon. You know, the term indispensable power was coined by one of my former bosses, Madeleine Albright, with the best of intentions. But even she, I think, has understood, yes, there's a role for American leadership. But the notion of indispensability implies that there can be nothing done for good without somehow the involvement of the United States. And I think we have, over the last 70 years, in my judgment, there have been moments where the United States, I think, has demonstrated real leadership, 1945 to 1950, perhaps the mid-70s, and during the late 80s. The last successful foreign policy that we had in this country, in which America did lead, was the first Bush administration, where America was admired, feared, and respected in the world in a way it is not now. And I suspect Gordon is right. The table has changed. Without the benefit, look, World War II was the last war that left the United States in a stronger position at home and with more influence on the world stage. We are now weaker at home in fundamental ways with less influence abroad. And I think that adjustment is critical. To Gordon's point, I really do think the question is, how much has the foreign policy team learned as a consequence? Because the world has changed since Joe Biden was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the 90s, and it's changed again since he was vice president. And it's all wise and good, fine to talk about reasserting American poverty back at the head of the table. But we really have to define exactly what that means. You know the old saw that a leader without followers is just somebody out for a walk. And we are going to be scrutinized in terms of our real capacity to lead. And the Europeans and others are worried that within 4 years, we're going to simply toggle back because of the nature of our divided, dysfunctional politics, in their view, perhaps to another Republican president, which may well, who may well be a nicer version, a more functional version of Joe Biden's predecessor, embodying his policies, though. So, and again, I think Gordon is right to argue that it's not yet clear when it comes to the real heavy lifting, China, Russia, trying to manage the broken, angry, dysfunctional Middle East, how the administration is going to cope.
And let me ask you about that, Gordon. Aaron's brought that up a couple times. I want to find your view, hear your view on how what Aaron referred to as our dysfunction, but how America's divided politics, how the insurrection, how the impeachment trial plays abroad, and what it means when the Biden administration is trying to conduct foreign policy in the months and years ahead.
I think it's going to be one of the hardest struggles that the Biden administration will have in enacting either domestic policy or foreign policy. And they're interrelated on this point. I think you're right, Jennifer, put your finger on the issue of what we look like to the rest of the world. It's not just the last 4 years. It's partly the decline in power over a longer period. But right now, we're not what, you know, the famous preacher in the 17th century called the shining city on the hill. We are a mess politically. We are about as fractious and divided. I've ever seen us. I can't imagine that we look like anything more than a third world country. It's kind of interesting that the Freedom House ranking of democracies in the world has seen the United States steadily decline over the last 10 years. We're now 33rd in the world by the standards of Freedom House's measures of what is a functioning democracy. We're not a functioning democracy, and it's very clear that things like the role of big money and dark money in politics, the role of a truly not democratic election system for the presidency, Electoral College is not a democratic institution. We gerrymander districts so that 90% or more of House districts are now safe for whoever the incumbents are. The weight of American politics is towards smaller and more rural states, though the population is concentrated on the East Coast and the West Coast. In many ways, this is not a democracy that can now function as a democracy. And when other countries look at us and see what the shining city was supposed to have been. I know Joe Biden likes to say, we're going to, you know, it's the power of our example, not the example of our power. And I'm for that. I agree with that notion. But right now, our example is not very compelling to anybody. And among the many ways that we're going to have to adapt to that reality, I think, is how what we say about our own democracy and what we tell other countries about theirs. We have a rather nasty habit over the last 60 or 70 years of telling other countries how to create functioning democracies and actually spend a lot of money to encourage them to create functioning democracies and have failed in almost every effort that we have made. We're now not in a strong position to say, and we've got a good example of how a democracy functions. So among the ambitions that I know President Biden has, which is this summit of the democracies that he wants to call later this year, what are the democracies? By what right do we call a summit of something called the democracies? And why are we advocating and creating coalitions of what we call democracies when our own democracy is as dysfunctional as is? That's going to require, I think, a very different, more realistic politics in terms of what we say about the promotion of American values. And I think President Biden comes from a generation where that rolled off the tongue. The values, we promote our values, they are democratic and free market values. Well, our free market is not competitive in the global economy like it used to be, and our democracy is in a shambles. So it kind of is going to force diplomats to step back and say, let's preach a little bit less and deal more equally and share power a little bit more.
Aaron David Miller, I want to talk about, I don't know if irony is the right word, but that your last book was entitled Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. And part of your analysis is that the way you have a great president is by having a really horrific crisis to steer the nation through. As you think about the research you did and the writing you did and the analysis you did, and now you look at what faces the Biden administration, I'm wondering if you want to rethink your title.
No, I don't. In fact, I think it's a reflection of our times. You know, we've had three undeniably great presidents. Most historians, ordinary citizens, journalists, and even those historians who study the presidency would agree that we had one president in the 18th century, one in the 19th century, and one in the 20th. Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. And I argue in the book that the key to their greatness was the formulation of the three C's. The first C is crisis. The founders anticipated and wanted to dilute power. And the only thing, frankly, that would create the kind of accretion of power necessary was a crisis so profound, so hot, so irrepressible that if it occurred, it required centralized leadership. But crisis alone wasn't enough. You needed character, the second C, and you needed capacity. The president needed to know how to move the system, how to work the system. Washington, Lincoln, and FDR had the three C's. And I would argue on paper, it's plausible to assume that Joe Biden has the three C's as well. But times have fundamentally changed. And I don't believe, now you could argue that in our divided polity in the wake of Fort Sumter, that the nation was more divided. After all, we endured an extraordinary period of civil war. But nonetheless, the crises we confront now are ones that don't unify. They tend to divide. And this is the basic problem. And on top of that, how do you have presidential greatness in a country where millions of Americans are arguing not about policy? That's going to characterize our political system forever. But who basically argue about reality, what the Rand Corporation calls truth decay. How can you have self-governance? How can a republic exist when millions of Americans can't agree on the basic empirical data that requires a kind of national consensus to give a president a mandate to lead? And look, I voted for Republicans and Democrats. I work for Republicans and Democrats. But I have to tell you, as divided as the Democratic Party may be on key issues, I've never seen a Republican Party as dysfunctional. Dysfunctional isn't even the right word. It's an enabling of a philosophy of the attainment of power at the expense of our own democracy. They acquiesce, they enable, they support, some oppose, but not enough. How do you actually give a president the kind of support that is necessary when 70 plus million Americans, as opposed to the other 70 or 85 million Americans, look at reality so differently? This is, to me, the greatest problem that Joe Biden is going to face.
We are talking about what the Biden administration faces in both foreign and domestic policy. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you'd like to ask our guests a question, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Thomas College, offering graduate programs with flexible learning options for advancing your career. Learn more at thomas.edu/GPS. New England Naturopathic Health, now accepting Anthem Insurance Plans. Details at naturopathicme.com. And Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, lemon and pesto butter Atlantic salmon and three other varieties found in the freezer at your local Hannaford.
What do these people think of me? It's a question that can act like an anchor, dragging us down and keeping us from succeeding.
They might tolerate you out of a sense of, well, you know, we should, but could they really believe in you?
How other people's stereotypes about us get inside our heads. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
And you can hear Hidden Brain this evening at 10 o'clock. Thank you, Greg from Lewiston, for donating your 2001 Lincoln Continental to Maine Public. Do you have an unneeded car or truck taking up a lot of room in your driveway? Consider donating it to Maine Public. It's easy and there is no cost to you. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details. Donated cars and trucks of any size make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the intersection of national and international challenges facing the Biden administration. Joining me, Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former State Department, had several jobs in the State Department. He was a Middle East analyst among those. He served as negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. Gordon Adams was the chief national security budget official for President Bill Clinton. He is emeritus professor at American University and currently a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. Share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Going to a call now from Allison Hodgkins at the World Affairs Council. Hi, Allison. Thanks for calling in. Hi, Allison. Are you there? Allison Hodgkins, can you hear me? Okay, I'll leave Allison's line open in case she comes on and go to Tony, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. I've got a question. I was just wondering why, with all of our different police agencies that we have, why isn't the FBI, the CIA, or even the Secret Service that protects the president not looking into who the QAnon people are? I mean, if they can go after child porn people and find them on the internet, why can't they find out who these morons who are spreading these QAnon conspiracies, why can't they find out who they are?
Gordon, I'll turn to you first.
My sense is that they are, in fact, doing that. There was a long period, mostly during the Trump administration, but frankly, going back a bit longer in the FBI, starting in 2001, when the focus in the agency was terrorism, 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 all Muslim, all international. And so we spent billions of dollars over the last 20 years chasing international terrorist organizations, both abroad and in terms of investigations here at home. And they, I think what basically happened is they took their eye off the ball. There was a lack of attention to the threat of domestic terrorism. Even given the Murrah Building attack in Oklahoma City, there was no willingness. And it's a complicated problem looking at domestic terrorism. It's complicated by the fact that those citizens of the United States are protected by rights of speech and assembly under the First Amendment to the Constitution. So there's always been the kind of a wariness to going after domestic organizations who might just be exercising rights of free speech and rights to get together. What has crystallized, I think, very strongly with January 6th and the absolutely unprecedented assault on the Capitol, an insurrection that had not been anticipated, had not been prepared for, that the agencies like the FBI, like the Secret Service, Department of Justice, have now actually begun taking what small work they were doing on domestic terrorist organizations and pumping it up. They're amping it up. There are more people now working in the Justice Department in this than there ever were, in the FBI than there ever were. It's a little bit late and the horse is kind of out of barn and down the road, but they are now doing the investigations. I think something like 160 or 70 people who participated in the attack on the Capitol have been arrested. There is serious scrutiny being given to organizations like the Proud Boys and QAnon. And we will probably have legislation, I think some's already been introduced, that would try to designate some organizations or give the government the capacity to designate some organizations as domestic terrorist organizations. But again, they're going to go very carefully, and the opportunity for lawsuits here is enormous because of the First Amendment to the Constitution. But I think we got the wake-up call. It's a little bit late, but it's going to be one of the many challenges that that President Biden is going to face.
And I want to turn to you as well, Aaron David Miller, talking about domestic terrorism.
It's an argument for turning D.C. into a state, actually, because if you look at the overlapping lines of authority, the missed signals, the, I would say, incompetence, and this is not a reflection on the heroic and brave efforts of those Capitol Police who are outnumbered, outgunned, figuratively speaking, in the face of an angry mob. Do you know that there were 100,000 references in the 30 days leading up to January 6th on social media to the phrase storming the Capitol? 100,000. How is it possible that an absence of coordination between the D.C. Metro Police, the FBI, the Capitol Police, led to a situation where, I mean, to say we were not prepared is an understatement. This is like 9/11, and I do not want to make the comparison for many reasons, but on one score, this was a failure, I think, of imagination and coordination. Had you had a consolidated effort where authority in the district was not so decentralized, and the district as a sort of an appendage, we saw this back in the summer in terms of the administration's desire to make a statement in front of Lafayette Square. So I agree with Gordon. I think it's a much more difficult problem. You've got 175 cases based on arrests out of about 800 people who have been identified, who were estimated to be having broken into the Capitol. And I think we're now focused on this. And it's still going to create a huge challenge, because spreading conspiracy theories as opposed to acting on them is a very tough circle to square. You can't ban QAnon unless prosecute QAnon, because even the ACLU, not even, the ACLU is arguing that even Biden's predecessor's remarks in the hour or so leading up to a mob marching to the Capitol falls under protected speech. So it's a tougher problem, but I think we're now focused on it.
Tony, thanks for your call. We're going to try to go to Allison Hodgkins again. Allison Hodgkins with World Affairs Council. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you for taking my call.
Terrific. What do you want to ask?
Well, we are having Michael Phelan, who is the director of the Afghan Study Group, which is a bipartisan study group co-chaired by former New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte, and they just released their findings on the future of Afghanistan. He's coming to speak with our members on the 24th of February, but I wanted to ask your guests what they thought about the findings in the report, particularly the recommendation that the troop withdrawal deadline that was negotiated by the previous, the Trump administration, be renegotiated. We've got violence escalating in Afghanistan, and I'm wondering how they might advise the Biden administration to proceed, and whether the meeting at the end of the month with the NATO defense ministers is maybe an opportunity to put some substance behind the America's back message that the Biden administration really wants to get out there. I'd love to hear their thoughts.
I'll turn to you, Aaron. Yeah, I'll turn to you, Aaron David Miller.
I mean, I think paradoxically, you're not going to see a dramatic redeployment of U.S. forces in Afghanistan anytime soon under this administration. The urge to head for the exits, I think, is palpable. I think that most of that team understands, and again, I don't mean to demean for a minute the sacrifices of those men and women who died in Afghanistan and whose injuries, life-crushing injuries, has fundamentally changed their lives and the lives of those around them. But our objectives in Afghanistan and the price that we have paid and the price the Afghan people have paid far outweigh any conceivable returns that we are getting. But at the same time, and I think that Biden foreign policy team is aware of that fact, I just think that this administration does not want to join in any sort of precipitous withdrawal from Afghanistan and be faced with, as any administration would, this sort of final authority for pulling American forces out and facing the consequences. However manageable those consequences may well be, I think you're going to see on this one a relatively cautious policy. Whether this can be renegotiated, the May deadline for withdrawal is not going to happen. I mean, I'd bet on that one. But I think you're going to end up with the same number of forces by year's end that we have there now.
And Gordon, anything to add to that?
Yeah, here I'd have to disagree a little bit, push back with Aaron. Historically, we made a couple of fatal strategic errors back 20 years ago. Strategic error number one was not so much going into Afghanistan to remove the Taliban and injure it against the United States, but the failure to stay around at that point was a critical strategic error. At that point, we had a lot of international funding, a lot of countries prepared to participate in some effort to create a survivable regime in Afghanistan. We did not do that. The regime has barely been survivable as a result. So the virtue of staying at this point, I think, is more for what the administration will see as face and credibility than it is for actually accomplishing a different outcome. I think the handwriting is on the wall in Afghanistan, and it's simply a question of everybody being willing to read it, which is the Taliban had controls a bigger part of the country than anybody else, and there is absolutely no will to go in and continue the fruitless effort to do something about it. So when I glanced at the summary of the Afghan Study Group study that I was referring to, and I kind of had a sinking feeling. It was kind of like the Iraq study group. Well, here we go again. We're going to try to make this look better than it's really going to look. I, for myself, thinking historically, I always go back to what Charles de Gaulle did in Algeria when he simply stood up in Paris and said, you know what? We cannot survive in Algeria. We are coming home.
It nearly cost him his life because the Algerian right-wingers and the paramilitary almost overthrew him. But it was an act of huge courage by the president of France to say, this will not be sustainable. We have to leave. And I think myself, my preference would be to say that's the May deadline and we are going to leave. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think Aaron's right. The administration is going to postpone that deadline. They're going to try to negotiate some more. And my own sinking feeling will just continue to sink.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. We are talking about the thorny challenges both home and abroad facing the Biden administration. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering basement waterproofing solutions, easternbasements.com.
For the first time in history, the Senate will try a former president.
If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him?
Former President Trump committed, in the view of many, including myself, the gravest offense ever committed by a president.
Join us for live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial starting today on NPR News.
And that coverage is scheduled right now to begin at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Is your business or organization ready to take on 2021? Maine Public can help connect you with Maine's largest radio audience to put you on the right trajectory. We've created a series of new underwriting opportunities called Launchpad packages that are specially designed to share your strategic messaging in an effective and budget-conscious way. For information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on support or contact our underwriting team at underwriting@mainepublic.org and see what we can do to help you. Again, that's underwriting@mainepublic.org. Thanks.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about international and national issues facing the Biden administration. My guests are Gordon Adams, a former official in the Clinton administration, and Aaron David Miller with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, also a former State Department Middle East analyst and author. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Barbara, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you.
Go ahead and ask your question. Yeah.
I wanted to ask if it isn't time for a new definition for bipartisanship. It seems to me that we keep holding it out there as the gold standard, but is it really? And should we redefine it in a much more broader context and really look to the American public as whether an issue receives bipartisan support? I just don't see historically that we've achieved any bipartisan results in, you know, decades.
So what you're saying is don't define bipartisanship by whether members of Congress on both sides of the aisle support something, but whether the actual people do.
Exactly. I think we're getting hung up by whether we get one or two people from the other party, both ways, whether it's Republicans or Democrats in charge.
And an example might be the pandemic relief bill?
Yeah, or even go back to Obamacare, where that was held up for months and months. And then Grassley finally said, there's nothing you can do to get us on board.
Okay. Aaron, thoughts?
Well, you have a divided, deeply divided American public. George Packer argues we've become two separate nations. Neither can conquer the other, and neither is going anywhere anytime soon. To make it worse, you have a, to say the least, dysfunctional political system. In my judgment, again, having worked for Republicans and Democrats and voted for Republicans and Democrats, the asymmetry here is striking. The Republican Party, whether by acquiescence or commission or omission, basically has committed itself to following its base and the whims and wishes and egos of still a single man who lacks formal power but maintains the loyalty of the large numbers of Americans and the Republican Party. At the same time, you have a system of governance which does require in order to create sustainable change, if you can get it, some sort of bipartisan consensus. I think the Biden administration recognizes to some degree, and the caller's intuition here, I think, is correct, that when it comes to the stimulus package, that the public wants this. The public needs this. And the Democrats have a mechanism in order to do it without Republican support, this reconciliation process. So I think there is a sense on the part of the administration that if we can't get Republican buy-in, let's try to sell this, and maybe it will be perceived and received by large elements of the American public in a bipartisan fashion as something that's good for them. And through that mechanism, through that means, through making institutions work, if not Congress, then through executive action or through this reconciliation process, you can deliver things to make government functional again. I'm a great supporter of bipartisanship because I think enduring change in this republic really requires it. Obamacare may be somewhat of an exception to that, but the tremendous moments in American history that have generated profound social and economic change came through conflict, through the heat of the bottom up rising to the top, but through a legislative process which, by acquiescence or full support, created a measure of bipartisanship that endured, whether that was three civil rights bills under Lyndon Johnson or whether it was Social Security under Franklin Roosevelt. So if we can get it, let's get it. But we're in a crisis now, and this administration needs to deliver.
Gordon.
Yeah. I'm always, the term bipartisanship at this point sometimes makes me want to reach for my political gun, as they say. I won't talk about real ones. That is to say, it's very hard to define what a bipartisan approach would be to something when one of the parties in bipartisan has devoted most of its membership and votes to what is essentially a cult, to a deeply divided sense of what the American will is and where the Americans want to go. The problem with turning it over to public polling and somehow finding a mechanism to institutionalize public polling is I think, insuperable. That is to say, there's no way to really operationalize a polling result, a popular will kind of result. We have institutions, dysfunctional as they are, representatives, the Senate of the United States, the presidency, that are supposed to be able to channel what the public wants to have. But as Aaron is saying, we've created a dysfunctional system that can't do that anymore. Half of one party, if not more, is captured in a cult. They're not prepared to operationalize anything that comes out of a public opinion polling, because public opinion polling makes it pretty clear that a lot of what the cult supports is not true. For example, the election outcome of 2020. And there are so many issues here that are crucial that we talked about on the show. Climate change is obviously one. We haven't talked much about that. COVID is another. What will be the bipartisan approach to inoculating the world, as Tony Fauci has said last week? We'll never really be secure until we've dealt with COVID the way we deal with measles and smallpox. In other words, international eradication. We're not safe until there's a global change here. So, and above all, the issue of race. When one of the parties is in thrall of a cult which essentially is oriented around the notion of white supremacy, it's going to be almost impossible to find a bipartisan basis to deal with the issue, the huge challenge, 400-year-old challenge of racism in America. I mean, this is why I don't want Biden's job, because the forces here are so insuperable. And right now, our system cannot operationalize what public opinion appears to be, because of all of the obstacles in the way and in terms of how we put the system together.
Barbara, thank you so much for your call. Going to go to an email here. This has come in from retired U.S. Ambassador Pamela White. She says, I think the challenge overseas is enormous. We have lost our moral authority. How can we promote democracy abroad when ours is so weak in the United States? Any concrete ideas? Thank you. You are great. Aaron.
With great humility, number one. And number two, I think Gordon referred to it in discussion of Afghanistan. We have to understand something, which we don't, and we never have. And I'm a proponent of American exceptionalism, but American exceptionalism stops at the water's edge. We are an exceptional country. We have non-predatory neighbors to our north and south. We have fish to our east and west, and we have created an extraordinary enterprise here. One of the only democracy in the world based on an idea. But we have to understand that we do not have the answers, certainly not the answers to the internal problems that beset so many countries in this world. And we need to understand that. And we also need to understand that even countries with authoritarian systems, this is not a poster child for China or Russia, authoritarian, abusive regimes. But these countries also have legitimate interests. And we have a very difficult time accepting that fact. So, I think humility is critically important. If Joe Biden goes ahead with his summit for the global summit for democracy, which he's promised to do in the first year, then it has to be done by first looking in the mirror, or even during the course of the summit, looking into the mirror and admitting to some degree that our moral authority is weakened and our system has broken down. And we can work with others to develop best practices. But our role in promoting democracy on the world around the world has always been a constrained one. And maybe Gordon can think of one example since 1945 in Japan and in Germany where the United States has interceded with political and economic support to fundamentally alter the internal politics of another nation and create a democracy where there wasn't one before. I can't think of one, frankly. And our role on responsibility to protect, to intercede, and to stop mass killing and genocide, Rwanda, Darfur, South Sudan, Syria, the Rohingya, the Uyghurs, I mean, we can't protect these people, or we've decided we won't.
And Gordon, the idea, how do we promote democracy in when we see what's going on here?
I frankly don't think that we have right now no standing. Or to put it another way, and literally, until we have healed our own political system, I don't think we have any more, as Aaron was suggesting, the credibility to suggest to anybody else how to deal with their problems. I'll give you one example. There's a lot of upset and concern, rightly so, about the way China is treating its Uyghur minority in Xinjiang province, concentration camps, brainwashing, even some have suggested genocide. It's an ugly, ugly mess, right? And at the risk of being accused of false equivalence, for 400 years, the United States systematically made life difficult for people who were captured at the shores of Africa and brought to the United States. We have not solved our race problem in the United States. And while we're not rounding African Americans up in concentration camps and re-educating them, we have, over decades, made it difficult for African Americans to get a good education, to get housing in the right places, to earn a decent job and make a decent wage. Right from the end of the Civil War through Reconstruction, through Jim Crow, through segregation, the history of oppression of a minority in the United States has a 400-year history. With what credibility do we turn and tell another country you have to treat your minorities differently, treat them the way we have treated ours over 400 years? I don't think so. So it means that the moral standing that we have to actually make this argument is shallow. It's extremely shallow. And I think, Aaron has hit the nail on the head here. It's we don't have the credibility to make that argument to other countries. Do as I say, not as I do.
That's not a policy anymore. I just don't think it's viable. And in order for us to be able to deal with other countries, we're going to have to recognize that other countries see themselves the way they see themselves. You know, a wise statesman once said, if you can't get inside the head of the other country's leadership and system, you're going to make a lot of foreign policy mistakes. And one of the mistakes we're clearly making now is to preach democracy on other countries when we don't practice democracy at home.
We only have a couple minutes left. I want to get to this email from John. He writes, it seems that Russia has gotten the best of us for 4 years. Please give some examples of how Biden will turn that around. More aggressive responses? Aaron, I know this needs more than 2 minutes, but go for it.
He's not going to turn it around. I mean, and it's true for China as well. We're talking about a policy, quote my colleague at Carnegie, Evan Feigenbaum, who works on China. We're talking in both cases, managed enmity. That's the best we're going to be able to do. Because both China and Russia and the their leaders depend on the United States in an adversarial role to maintain their power, to mobilize their national ethos. And we can find ways to cooperate on discrete issues with the Russians on arms control, because the extension of New START with the Chinese, maybe on climate, and maybe on global health. But most of these problems are going to remain unresolved at the end of Joe Biden's 4 years, or if he's reelected, at the end of 8.
Gordon, just a few seconds. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, this comes back to the notion of the U.S. as the indispensable nation. I agree with Aaron. We're not going to turn Russia around. Napoleon tried to invade and failed. Hitler tried to invade and failed. Without invading, which would fail, we're not going to be able to remake the Russian system. And trust me, when I was in the Clinton administration, we put a lot of money and effort into doing that, precisely to establish a democracy in Russia. It failed, because we can't tell another country how to organize their affairs and get the outcome that we want when we do.
Well, thank you so much to our guests today for being here with us. Gordon Adams was the chief national security budget official for President Clinton. He is emeritus professor at American University and currently a fellow at Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. He's a resident of Brunswick and a poet. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former State Department Middle East analyst. He served as negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations and is a CNN Global Affairs analyst. His most recent book is The End of Greatness, with Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This show was engineered by John Keimel. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.